back on the Fan Morning Show, Sportsnet 590 fan Justin and Ailish. Happy Baby Friday, everybody. Hopefully, Embryo Friday didn't ruin your...
Excuse me?
You never heard us say that?
No.
Embryo Friday's Wednesday, Baby Friday's Thursday, God. Regular Friday's Friday. It was a tough Embryo Friday night for the Raptors. Let's talk to our guy, Michael Grange, our insider, brought to you by Don Valley North Lexus, where you can expect excellence online and in the showroom. Visit DonValleyNorthLexus.com. It's Michael Grange, Sportsnet NBA columnist and insider. How's it going this morning, Grange?
It's very well, Ailish. How are you?
Very well. That's good. I like the positivity coming through the phone. You feeling that way about the Raptors? Is there something that we can feel a little positive silver lining or no?
Well, they scored 123 points.
There you go.
That's pretty good. And Fred VanVleet was, that's probably the best he's played offensively, certainly this season, with 39, season high, and just looked really physically healthy and strong and determined. Mm-hmm. That two games in a row, I thought he looked really good like that. And Scotty Barnes, a few defensive miscues aside, again, probably the most assertive and, comfortable and in rhythm he's looked offensively as well. So you can hang your hat on that a little bit. There's a punchline there. I'll let you guys make it.
Yeah, I mean, I think we made it in the first hour. Too many punchlines, too many attempts at punchlines. But really, you know, I guess the story of the game is the difference between the three-point production. And if there's like, you know, there are multiple issues with the season. There are a lot of things to be concerned about to sort of realize are maybe fundamental flaws, but the three-point shooting seems to be the most glaring one, plus 33 from beyond the arc for the Sacramento Kings. The fact that they took 46, I don't know what it really says about them necessarily, other than they were hitting them at a decent enough rate to do that. But the Raps only hitting six, only attempting 21, is that really the main issue for them right now?
Well, the attempts, I think, were almost intentional. You know, I think Fred's dialed back his... I mean, we've seen games where he's taken 12, 13, 14, 15 threes. And when he's making six or seven or more, it looks great. And then, you know, he's had a few 3 or 12. So I think he's dialed that back. He was 2 of 8. And I think there were some more... You know, when you put that in the lineup, for example, your threes might go down a little bit. So I think there's just an effort to maybe punch the lane more, get to the free throw line more, and and generate some offense that way. And for the most part, they were obviously successful doing that. I think bigger picture, you know, if and when Otto Porter ever gets healthy, I don't think this team is going to be a really good three-point shooting team. I mean, they just don't have enough guys who do it well enough, consistently enough, to say that, you know, they're going to be, you look at the teams that are, you know, and by the way, Sacramento is one of them. You look at one of the really good 3-point shooting teams in the league, and they have six or seven guys who are, you know, capable of making two or three a night minimum. The Raptors aren't that, but you know, what's really holding them back is they can't be the worst. Right. And I don't think anyone expected them to be the worst. You know, if you presume guys are going to sort of creep back to their career averages, they won't be the worst. But, until that goes on, it's going to be tough. And I think that just as important as the fact they're not making threes, which is obviously very important, is it just puts so much stress and pressure on the rest of your game. And I think you saw that on the Sunday night game against Orlando, where I thought there was a really determined first half and things, you know, they looked like they were really playing to a certain game plan. And then the second half, Orlando makes a flurry of threes, the Raptors don't. And it's just hard to keep on, you know, hang on to the rope. And I thought, you know, there's just always stretches in games where, you know, it looks like the offense is kind of affecting the defense a little bit. And last night, I don't know if that was the problem, but the issue with Sacramento as well was, you know, sort of those 46 threes that the 17 makes, like how many of those 17 makes were contested? I'd say a very low number. And I think it just speaks to, you know, a kind of a malaise maybe that sets in a little bit when you're just struggling to, to make shots of your own.
Aren't you setting a pretty low ceiling if the intention from a three-point shooting perspective is to just not be the worst? Like, I understand that not being the worst can put them in a decent position, but how many, like, truly competitive teams can shoot in the bottom third of the NBA from beyond the arc?
No, that's a great point. And, you know, if you look at effective field goal percentage, which kind of calculates, includes the value of three-point shots with, you know, two-point field goals, the Raptors, I think, are 27th. They've been lingering down around there all year. And the teams that are in that neighborhood are bad, right? Like, it's Detroit Detroit's down there. I'm blanking on all the terrible teams right now. Houston, San Antonio. You know, the only team, a good team that's in that region with the Raptors is Denver. I think they're 28th, but Denver's, you know, the first one or two best offensive team in the league, so they get away with it. So, yeah, you're right. I think long term, if your bar is to be a bottom third or, you know, bottom quarter three-point shooting team in this league, your ceiling is low. I think what needs to be kept in mind is they are so good, and I know you guys have talked about this, they're so good at certain elements of the game. And last night, for example, I think they only turned it over 7 or 8 mm-hmm. times. They lead the league in not turning it over. They lead the league in turning over other teams. They just almost always generate extra possessions for themselves. And so, you know, they're very successful with that style. And I think as much as Nick Nurse, you know, he's kind of a popular guy to bring the heat on, you know, lately as things go bad, coaches always wear it. But, you know, they have a playing style that executes at a high level in target areas. But if what's undoing them is that in a couple of other key measures, they are very near the bottom of the league. And if they can improve those key measures, one of them is making threes and just making shots generally. The other is suppressing some shots. Like when they don't turn over other teams score pretty easily. And if they can just bump those bottom line numbers up, and maybe a short-term goal would be, you know, mid-pack or bottom or top two-thirds of the league, you know, the wins would follow. I don't think, to your point, Justin, I don't know if titles follow. But, you know, let's take some baby steps here.
Another tangible thing I think the Raptors, you know, can set their eyes on improving would be defensively. I mean, like, they have praised themselves and prided themselves on being a very strong defensive team. We haven't really seen that as of late consistently. I know OG wasn't in the lineup yesterday, who's, you know, a deep defensive player of the year. We put him in that conversation. But how tangible, for your perspective, is it that they can really hone in on that and make some sustainable changes and improvements that can be an area of strength again?
You know, I think there it's a little bit personnel related. So, you know, I think you have to go at what we've seen now for 30 games, and it's been consistent almost regardless of who's in the lineup. You know, as we were talking about, they do a great job in forcing turnovers. They definitely can make life difficult for other teams. They do a good job when they, you know, if they hone in on another team's star, they're usually pretty successful in kind of disrupting top players. OG's obviously a huge, huge figure in that. But, you know, I think that they're missing a piece or two defensively, and one of them is an effective rim presence. And they, you know, teams, when they get in the paint against Toronto, it's pretty comfortable for them most of the time. I think there's some hope Christian Coloco can fill that gap a little bit, but he just is so short offensively right now, and he's still so young defensively that it's kind of too much to ask. And so I think, you know, the easy answer for me to say is, you know, they'll be better defensively when OG is back. They'll be better defensively when Christian Sachua is back. You know, but I mean, to Justin's point, good teams, you know, every team in this league, you know, I think too much is made of the Raptors being shorthanded at times. Every team in this league is shorthanded, and certainly teams that come into the Raptors building are routinely shorthanded for various reasons. You know, so if you're not able to play through the odd You know, right now, you know, somebody who's hurt or a little swipe of injuries, then, you know, you're probably just not that good. So I think you're right. Defensively, you know, some numbers are really encouraging and I think maybe even misleading in terms of how good they are. But the number one job is, you know, making it hard to make shots. And the Raptors, you know, I think because of sometimes the style they play where they're so aggressive on the ball and so, you know, aggressive up the floor, it leaves them really vulnerable. And unless they can address that and by adding some kind of rim protection or, you know, until some of their guys get back and maybe their rotations get a bit tighter, you know, it's going to be a problem.
Yeah, I'm struggling to shake the fact that I just feel like the Raptors operate on such thin margins. Like we're talking about, you know, one injury and it really affects things. A bad night when you turn the ball over just a little bit, it really has a big effect. If you're not turning the ball over yourself, well, can you even run the offense that you want to run? When you're depending on all those things, it's got the pressure to be perfect. It just feels like it's there. And if it's not perfect, if it's not well-oiled, it seems to fall apart. Whereas other teams that have a little bit more room for error because they can, hey, just shoot the lights out to make up for things, don't really have those issues. Is there, like, is there anything to that, that the margins are just too thin for this team?
I think you're absolutely correct. You're absolutely correct. You know, and I think there's different ways to slice this. And, you know, I think we'll see, you know, if they can kind of put together a second half a little bit reminiscent of what they did last season. But I'm suspecting that's less likely than, well, it is less likely. It might happen, but, I mean, you can't depend on winning 65% of your games after not winning at that rate, you know, for half the season. And I think when you boil all that down, what it says is your team isn't good enough. And I think there's, you know, there's some really, really good pieces on this roster. And you know, you kind of know who they are and what they are. Their performance level of them is kind of varied. But I think, you know, once you get past four or five or six players, all of which, you know, several of them kind of overlap in their skills, you know, there's a lot of gaps. And, you know, if you look back at teams in this organization in the past, they were able to fill some of those gaps internally with, you know, some lucky drafts, some, you know, a couple of savvy acquisitions, whatever it might be. And that's not really before anyone's eyes right now. Obviously, things look a little worse now because, you know, they've lost, what, 6 of 8 or 5 of 6 or whatever it is. But, you know, I think if you're being pretty objective, that, you know, what you say exactly is teams that are good find different ways to win because they don't have to only win one way. Mm-hmm. And the Raptors kind of right now can only seem to win one way. And it's just not a, it's a bit of a smoke and mirrors act. And it's, I think guys, it, you know, it's a hard one to sustain.
You had an excellent article at sportsnet.ca, Grange, laying out what the Raptors have ahead of them, which is 13 games against plus 500 teams, which will bring them to 40 games on the season. If they reach the halfway point and things, I won't even hypothetical it, is it now or never for this iteration of the Toronto Raptors? Like over these 13 games, do they have to prove something to preserve themselves?
Yeah, I think that's a fair thing to say. You know, and this has been kind of looming for a while, even this time last year, you could sort of see it. And, you know, when they went on their tear in the second half, it kind of changed people's perspectives a little bit, but, or you saw, you know, what the future could look like. But in the absence of team success, all of a sudden you're like, okay, you know, you have a soon to be 29-year-old point guard who's heading into an option, you know, an option year and would like a long-term lucrative extension. You have a soon to be 29-year-old primary option in Pascal Siakam. That was Fred VanVleet I'm talking about. Pascal Siakam, who's like your clear number one option offensively, your best player. You know, if he gets all NBA honors, which, you know, he's kind of trending towards, well, he'll be in position to look for a 5-year contract for nearly $300 million. OG Anunoby will be in a position to be offered an extension. He won't take it because the amount they can offer him won't be enough based on his value. So he's going to be a year away from free agency, and he'll be looking for, let's presume he does end up, you know, all NBA or maybe defensive player of the year. That's probably not likely, but you know, he'll be looking for a contract in the, you know, $160, $180 million range, if not more. Precious Achiuwa, you know, if he comes in as a second half like he did last year, he'll be looking for an a rookie year extension at a big number. You kind of keep going on down that list, and on each individual case, you can see why the argument would be made and why, you know, somewhere in the marketplace there might be versions of those contracts available, certainly comparables. But if you're a team after 40 games that's under 500 and looking at the play-in, and if you're a team that finishes the season in 10th place, which is where they are now, and, you know, doesn't even make it out of the play-in, you know, I think as a management group, you got to go, well, how can we possibly invest these kinds of terms and these kinds of dollars in a team that, you know, lost in the playoffs in the first round of Philadelphia a year ago, regressed this year? Where does that leave you? And so I think that's where the real questions are going to come. And, you know, the longer the team struggles, the answers get tougher and tougher. Or maybe they get easier, but the decisions get tougher.
You wrote that eyes are on them in terms of the Raptors and their players. And yesterday we talked about some rumors that circulated around with the word fireworks could happen with this team. And I think you're talking about the direction it could go. Fireworks could be a great thing where they could be, you know, looking to maybe add, but fireworks could also go another way, as you mentioned about, you know, maybe trading off some of these pieces. What's the appetite around the organization to kind of repeat that Tampa tank that happened, especially so close to having a successful championship season?
Well, the appetite, you know, I haven't, you know, that conversation hasn't come up with anyone. Like it just hasn't seemed like, you know, it might be different like tomorrow if I talk to somebody, but, you know, I think the appetite is in the short term is nil, right? I mean, I can tell you, you know, privately, the ambitions and the confidence for this team were high, which isn't to say I don't think they felt like they had a championship team, but I think that they, you know, at the highest levels of the organization, they believe that some combination, if not all four of their so-called core four, could be part of a championship team and maybe important parts of a championship team. So if they miscalculate on that, then, you know, that's where all these other problems come in. And, you know, so I think that there is a bit of a crossroads and they could, you're right. They could go different ways, right? Like they could go, you know, we need to really support, as I mentioned, you know, Pascal Siakam and Fred VanVleet, you know, they're even OG Anunoby, they're veterans. You know, I think the hope is Scotty Barnes could really quickly bridge the gap and be in a position to kind of elevate them sooner than later. That's, you know, so far hasn't quite happened this year. And so do you go out to the marketplace, spend some of your future, you know, draft capital as it would have to be, and supplement where this team is weak? And, you know, to me, it's shooting and rim protection are the two obvious places. And then, so you're basically doubling down, right? You're like, you know, we're going to spend some of our future capital to make this team that we believe in better. And then, you know, the reverse is that is if the evidence mounts and they kind of begin to question, you know, what they have and question if they can afford to invest in what they have, you know, then at that point it is asset management. And you know, you can't be in a situation where you're, you know, losing quality players that you don't necessarily want to sign, aren't able or don't want to sign long term without getting in return. And then maybe at that point you have to make a pivot. So, yeah, fireworks. I mean, I don't think I was using that word, but I mean, I think the Raptors are definitely one of those teams that is, you know, I can tell you, like, you know, there were other organizations in Orlando, like there are teams looking at them, there are teams asking questions about their players, you know, because they feel like they could be a team that could go either way, and people want to be prepared.
And either way, it has to be decisive, right? Like, I feel like the worst spot you could be in is be like, okay, we're going to do a little bit of this or a little bit of that, because in the end, that might not really accomplish anything and really just push a problem down the road. However, to borrow, like, maybe the worst phrase in hockey, the hockey trade, which is, you know, just trying to have a trade that helps both teams, that isn't about the future with one team or so on and so forth. You laid out two things that they need, clearly shooting and rim protection. Hard to satisfy those both, you know, with one fell swoop. However, I don't even know if the Raptors have a surplus. And a surplus is something you need in order to make a quote-unquote basketball trade. Do you see an area that they could kind of take from to better optimize the roster if and when a hypothetical basketball trade could potentially present itself?
No, I mean, you zeroed in, I think, on maybe the most essential point. And you know, if you look back, you know, it's kind of interesting and maybe even worthwhile to look back at other Raptors teams, you know, that Masai Ujiri has kind of presided over, and you go back to, well, what stage is this group compared to, say, what, you know, the Kyle DeMar group were in, you know, 2013-14, 14-15, you know, where in that window are they, and how did they kind of become a conference finals team and eventually a championship team? And, you know, when you kind of look at that, and I'm not sure it's the right way to kind of go through all this, but it's an interesting way. And when you look at that, I mean, one thing that really jumps out is how many quality players the Raptors had under contract, both, you know, that they drafted, that they developed and acquired. And, you know, I always go back to that, the 17-18 team that won 59 games. And, you know, Norm Powell, who's a key rotation piece on a team that a lot of people think can win an NBA title in the Clippers, you know, he was the 11th man, you know, like he could barely get on the floor. You had, you know, Pascal Siakam and VanVleet playing, you know, early in their careers. People didn't know how good they were going to be, and we know now. So from there, they were in a position they could consistently over time deal from strength, and that's how they got Kawhi Leonard, that's how they got Marc Gasol, and that's how they were able to win. That I don't see that in this group. I mean, I think there's some interesting young players, and that's kind of another story, is that they haven't really had an opportunity to develop on the floor for whatever reason. And so if you're trying to put together a deal, you know, you're not really flush with the kind of really exciting young players or interesting young players or affordable young players that kind of other teams might, you know, want to step up and grab. So I think it's more of cobbling together some of the contracts on your roster, you know, the Thad Youngs, maybe a Chris Boucher, maybe a, you know, a Ken Burt, something like that. And, you know, just to match money. And then you have no choice but to throw in a bunch of draft capital, you know, depending on how good a player you're trying to bring back the other way. And that kind of, you know, that's where you kind of chosen a path. I think, you know, the one interesting thing about going down that road, and I kind of touched on that in the article, is in some ways you might as well, because, you know, you're already down a certain path here in Toronto now as it is. And if you want to stay competitive and you do believe in what you have, you might as well support it. And if it doesn't work out at that point, well, all of a sudden you're the seller. And, you know, you're moving off a lot of your kind of key players, and you're the one rebuilding. You're the one gathering draft capital and all that. So if you do send some out the window, there's a reasonable chance you can get some back. But, you know, they're tough decisions. And, you know, I don't know what our conversation would be like if, they won that game against the Lakers, they go to Orlando, win two, come back against a Sacramento team on the second night of back-to-back, get that one, and you know, you're 16-12, and, you know, we probably have a much different conversation.
Yep, lots to consider. I mean, it is a small sample that we're, you know, is coloring our sort of opinions right now, but the sample will grow on the path to the halfway point of the season, and I think we can be a little bit more decisive with our opinions, and maybe management will be more decisive with their decision-making. Grange article up right now at sportsnet.ca. We appreciate you taking the time after a game night.
Thank you. All right, guys. Have a great time.
Thanks, Grange. That insider was brought to you by Don Valley North Lexus, where you can expect excellence online and in the showroom. Visit donvalleynorthlexus.com.
We got to rush into something to chew on, brought to you by Great Canadian Meats.
Yum, yum, yum.
So we got a great guest on the other side calling from Doha. So finally, after much anticipation, the Kevin Kiermaier details have come out about his contract with the Toronto Blue Jays. A $9 million one-year deal, as reported by BNS. Took a while because I think he had to do a physical, whatever, make sure he was healthy.
About half a Bellinger?
Half a Bellinger. Obviously, the domino effect after that was Chris Bassett signing, but now we have some details on what Kevin Kiermaier is going to cost. 32-year-old. We know that his defensive prowess is impeccable.
Mm-hmm.
He's going to bring a lot to the outfield there. Strong defender. Might not be an every single day player, but he's going to help bolster that defensive backing for the Toronto Blue Jays, and now we know he costs $9 million.
Hard to nitpick a one-year deal at that price. Mm-hmm. On a player that does multiple things for you. It's not a catch-all solution by any means to the outfield. It requires another move, but I don't know how you could look at that deal and paint it as a negative. So good work by the Blue Jays front office.
Good work. All right, we got Martin Tyler on the other side of the break, World Cup play-by-play announcer for SBS, which is Australian rights holder, and Sky Sports analyst. Is this the perfect fitting final? Argentina, France, and is this Messi's golden lap? That's next. Justin and Ailish on The Fan Morning Show.
Breaking down the top stories in the NHL every day. The Jeff Merrick Show. Subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
We never talked about the World Cup song.
Is this it?
I think so. It is, yeah. I mean, nothing's going to be better than Waka Waka.
Is this Shakira?
Shakira was Waka Waka. There's no way she's... This is her as well. I wish she gets to do... Ozuna. There's no way she gets to do multiple World Cup songs. But Waka Waka is the best. Waka Waka. Like, you know that... Like, it still slaps.
I don't know that at all. I don't even know what you're...
Are you kidding?
...going on about right now.
Waka Waka. The World Cup song from 2010.
We'll come
it's
into
time
the
for
8 o'clock.
Africa. Da, na, na, na.
Oh, okay,
hey,
okay,
hey,
okay.
Waka Waka. What do you live under a rock?
I don't know. You picked like two words out of the song.
It's called Waka Waka. So that's why I picked those words.
That's fair.
Pitbull had one. Ricky Martin had one. Nicky Jam. Wave and Flag. Remember Wave and Flag?
Yep. I do.
Yeah. So this one just doesn't resonate with me as much.
Well, either way, the World Cup song will be blaring through speakers in Qatar on Sunday because we've got a brilliant final.
Oh, yes, we do.
With France and Argentina. You didn't get to watch much of yesterday's game, eh?
I was out and
0%? About. 0%?
Well, I didn't watch. Yeah, no, I didn't watch anything.
Your pick, too.
My pick.
How'd you find out?
All I got was the text from Justin saying, what did you say? You're like World Cup foursy.
Football four? No, footy fours.
Footy
Fours.
And I said, that's right.
Yeah, you nailed it.
An oracle.
And I guess you didn't see the end of the game where there was like, Morocco was getting chances for like no reason. It was kind of annoying. But France holds on. They always hold on. France is like, and we're going to ask Martin Tyler about this in a second. France has an uncanny ability of just overcoming. Like they're, I was trying to find like parallels to what the team is. Like a team that always just comes through. It's kind of Boston Bruins-esque.
I was just going to say that, and then I
but
bit
Boston
my tongue.
The Boston Bruins do, like France is more successful. Like, they always, always, always find a way to do it. And it's the depth of the squad, and it's all that. Top-end talent. They've got Mbappe. They got a lot. I get it. But they were outplayed by England, and they outplayed Morocco, but it was still, like, sweat-free when it wasn't dominant. Mm. Like, maybe that's the key. It's like not dominant for France in the least bit. Hugo Lloris has given up a goal in every single game aside from the semifinal that he's played in. They give up goals. They've given up too many goals probably to be in the place that they're in, and yet they always endure. They always push through. They always have success. It would be nice to be in that position.
Yeah. You will have some success, hopefully, with the snowman that you're going to be building.
Well, I got the team that endures.
I don't believe that it's written in the stars this time around. I think it's in Argentina.
You think it's written in the stars for Lionel Messi?
I do think so.
Yeah. I tend to agree with you. I think they're the higher performing team to this point. They shook off that loss to Saudi Arabia. Weird, weird, weird. But they found a way. They found a way to recover their World Cup, and they've been by far the most impressive team, led by far the most impressive player, who's 35 years old and apparently toying with the idea of going to MLS. That's the only, Messi's already said Sunday's final will be his last World Cup appearance. Rumors unconfirmed that he's going to MLS in Miami. All that Apple money, I believe it is, or Amazon money, either way, doesn't matter. No free ads. Injected into MLS.
Walmart or something.
Walmart. No, it's going on a different streaming service, I think.
Oh.
So anyway, a lot of money is going to be injected in the system.
A separate at MLS. League that has Walmart money now.
And it looks like he's going to be scooping up a lot of that. But this guy is dominating the next generation of great players.
Yeah, when do you decide that this is it? He's 35 years old.
Like, why not try to win more? 4 years might be asking too much.
Yeah.
But why decide already, especially when you haven't won it yet? Let's say it goes France's way. Mm-hmm. Messi's already said, he can change his mind, whatever. It's not a big deal. But if you already said it beforehand, this is going to be the last. If you lose, then you don't actually have the fairy tale ending to your career. And you close the door on the career already. If he goes to MLS, it's going to be really, really difficult. Because let's be honest, his play might drop. The standard might drop. He's not going to have to work as hard.
It's true.
Not even close to keep up as a 35, 36-year-old at the highest in the Champions League, the highest divisions of European football. You got to be all in. I feel like he can be half in semi-retirement at MLS at Miami.
This is the argument that we had yesterday with Jeff Merrick, that maybe Ovi, after his prolific career, wants to go play in the KHL for a year.
And that's a bummer. I'm all for... Beckham coming over was really cool.
Because he's not Messi.
I just think he's still the best. The way he treated, I always butcher his name, Gvardiol for Croatia, maybe the top defensive player at the entire tournament, also eligible for the Best Young Player Award. Mm-hmm. We're talking about maybe for the next 15 years, one of the best center backs in European football. And Messi turned him inside out and set up Julian Alvarez, I believe it was, for the third goal to basically secure the golden ball, at least in my opinion. Just based on that alone. Put him in front-running position for the golden boot. It was the moment of the World Cup for Messi, and it was just a perfect example of the fact that he can still dominate anyone at 35 years old, that he's still the best player on the pitch, that he still has the magic, that he can still dominate the highest level of the sport. And if you're transitioning to MLS when you're still at the highest level, it would be like Ovi leaving 5 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Oh. Where he's in the middle of winning Rocket Richards and then goes plays in Russia. It's not the same. Because, of course, Messi's been there, done it all. Already surpassed Gretzky, if you want to equate those things. I just think he has more to give. But again, if you just want to end up on top, finish things on top, have a semi-retirement, take loads of money, live in Miami. I get it. But in terms of the top level of football, he still has it.
He can be like Jager, keep playing into his 50s, pushing his retirement back.
I don't think anyone's like Jager.
We're working on getting Martin Tyler on the phone, by the way. Qatar service is shaky at this hour. It's coming. It's coming. What do you think of this? We didn't even talk about it. Saturday is the bronze medal, the third place
bronze
game.
Bronze medal game, yeah, third place game.
Yeah, Croatia and Morocco.
It's kind of tough, especially this time of year, because we're having a Winter World Cup. Club teams are waiting to get started again. I don't know if there are games this weekend, the Premier League and so on and so forth. There probably should be, because there's only four teams still in Qatar. I guess it would be difficult if you're the English Premier League and England's still playing and there's like great players on every team.
Yeah,
missing.
It looks like they don't play till Boxing Day.
Full break, like a full 4 or 5 week break for all these domestic leagues. And it feels like it's kind of unnecessary, especially when a game like a third place game means nothing. And a lot of those players could go home and just get back to training at least while the reserves play more games. I don't know. It just feels like, why hold up the entire football world for a third place game, especially in season? But this is the plan they made when they awarded Qatar the World Cup. I kind of liked the Winter World Cup.
You did? Really?
It was not. Maybe it was just because we were doing, I'm doing this job, we're talking about it all the time.
The
it's
radio.
Something to do during the day. It's when we're off. It's not really competing with anything else.
The timing.
I guess if we got to summer, we'd be like really diving into it because we wouldn't have the NFL.
I think you would like it in the summer more because you only talk about Blue Jays for months. So
exactly. It's a little bit more difficult. Anyway, we're connected now with Martin Tyler, World Cup play-by-play announcer at SBS and Sky Sports analyst. Martin, thanks for coming on. And let's begin with this, not waste too much time. The opportunity here is massive for Leo Messi. Is this the fitting final chapter? Is this potentially the end to the perfect footballing story?
Well, it is. Of course, it's not given by any means. France obviously want to hold on to the World Cup. Being top of the world, it takes a long time to get there. And if you can stay there for more than one tournament, it's rather like a president staying in office for another go. You know, they want to stay in office as the world champions. So Messi's got that to deal with. He's been in very good form. He's defying the aging process. We thought he might be a fading star at this tournament, but he's a shining star. It would be. I mean, it's one of those romantic stories you make a movie out of, but whether it happens in real life, we'll see.
Is he a golden ball lock at this point? I think I'm under the impression that the voting happens before the final, just based on his resume. Has he been far and away the highest performing player at the World Cup?
Well, he's won it before, but not won the World Cup. So I don't know whether that'll count too much if they lose. He won it in 2014. So it's, I don't know. I'm not on the voting panel. It probably is done before. I think the reporters and the analysts who basically vote scattered to the winds after the final whistle in the World Cup final on Sunday. So, yes, it will be voted for. It's not today, certainly tomorrow. And whether it'll be announced, I presume it'll only be announced on the day. But, yeah, he's leading the way. He's not the only one. Antoine Griezmann of France is doing extremely well, as is the France captain, Hugo Lloris, who held the World Cup aloft 4 years ago. So whether the result of the final would influence the vote, I don't think it will, because, as you say, I mean, Zinedine Zidane got it in 2006, just before he was sent off in the final, which rather tarnished the award.
Martin, not to look too far ahead, but after this World Cup, there's, you know, the idea that maybe Messi heads to MLS, which would be nice for us here on the other side of the continent, but maybe a shame or a little bit of taking the shine off the end of his career here if this is his last World Cup appearance and this is the way he goes off into the sunset. How do you view the way that a legend kind of transitions into the next part of his career and if the MLS is the right path for him?
I think it's how much he wants to play. And my view is that he can play at the level he's playing at for a little bit longer yet. I mean, he could even 3.5 years to the next World Cup when we revert to the June-July dates. So he's in very good shape. Obviously, it's about appetite, hunger to do it. If he doesn't win on Sunday, maybe he'll have a second thought about it. But players have done it for years, coming to the MLS. Before the MLS, it was the NASL, and Pelé came, and Franz Beckenbauer, Johan Cruyff, Bobby Moore, all famous people of their generation. I don't know how much it helps the league. It certainly helps their bank balance. And it's an increasingly good standard. As we saw, the US team actually performed very well here, as did Canada, without maybe taking away too much in terms of the statistics of it. But the gap between the top teams and those aspiring to be at that level is closing, and the World Cup has shown it. So, yeah, good luck to him. He's bought the right to say wherever he wants to go. There'll be no shortage of offers, but we'll see.
Standing away of the perfect send-off, if a send-off is what Leo Messi does, chooses, is France. And France has the uncanny ability to succeed on the World Cup stage, on the world stage, in nation-to-nation competition. What makes France different? What makes them special from an organizational standpoint? How do they continue to have such great success in these moments?
Well, Didier Deschamps is a simple answer. He was captain when they won in 98. He's been through this process. He's been coach for over 10 years now. He's really central to the process of knitting together the talents. I think that's for producing players. There is still a hunger, a desire to achieve in life from areas that maybe even today's world we can talk about being underprivileged. Certainly difficult times growing up makes athletes want to express themselves at the very top. I think there's a scattering of players who come to that category. Usually each round when you look at what France have done, it's not such a super footballing country. I mean, Ligue 1 is dominated by Paris Saint-Germain, and a lot of the players decide to move on. Kylian Mbappe was on the verge of moving on, but they came to some rather lavish contract for him to stay. But I guess the next phase of his career will be outside France. But it's always been a great invention about France. You know, a lot of the pioneers for these competitions, Jules Rimet, for a start, who was the thinking brains behind having a World Cup in the first place, Henri Delaunay for the European Championship. There's been the L'Equipe newspaper was very much behind the Champions League and European football coming in. So for a good time, France didn't have the on-field talent to go with the brains off the field, but they've got the balance now, and they deserve to be in the final. I don't think they're quite as good as they were 4 years ago, but they know how to win. They find a way to win.
We're chatting with Martin Tyler, World Cup play-by-play announcer and Sky Sports analyst. Given the expectations coming in and the history that they made, becoming the first African nation to reach the semifinals, did Morocco have one of the most successful World Cup runs that we've seen?
Yes. Simple answer, yes. They did it in a very impressive way. They recognized their responsibilities to their own country, but also the responsibilities to Africa and the Arab world as well. They've made history, but they didn't settle for just making history by getting to the semi-final. They gave France a really good game. They had some problems with injuries that rather caught up with them to some extent, but it was really touch and go. And you saw the celebrations from Deschamps and his coaching staff and the players at the end. They knew they'd been in a really tough game. So Morocco, like a number of African countries, is now working on a system of producing players. They have academies for youngsters that are of very high standard. And I would say that's what's been missing for Africa never winning a World Cup. And so the Morocco have not just done themselves proud, I think. They've shown the way that this is going to take African football forward in the years to come. It's always been a talent, but turning them into super professional players and getting them really a structure behind the team to we've heard lots of sort of disputes in the past, rows over bonuses and coaches coming and going. There's a steadiness now to their admin, and it's showing with some excellent performance on the field. I really, really enjoyed watching Morocco, and they've still got another game to play, of course. Mm-hmm. They could finish third, which would be a great achievement.
All eyes will be, you know, starting on Saturday, but mostly looking forward to Sunday's World Cup final. So let's finish with this. If you're looking at both teams, the storylines aside, who's got the edge in this World Cup final?
I don't know. I'm not a predictor. I'm a describer. We could talk for the rest of the afternoon, talking about the rest of the day. in your case, we could, because it's, you know, there are so many variables, which is what makes it such a great game. Mm-hmm. And at the end, you can say, well, that variable decided the result. Both teams are fiercely proud of their achievements to get this far, but they've not come here just to make up the numbers in the final. France are desperate to be the first nation for 60 years to retain the World Cup. It was a wonderful achievement if they do that. And, of course, Argentina, plus the Messi factor, are a really, a really passionate football nation. They've got amazing fans here. They'll certainly win the battle of the supporters. Because I don't know how they managed to get here in such numbers, but all you see is these light blue and white striped shirts walking around Doha waiting for the big day to come. So it's intriguing. It's what it should be. It's an elite final for what's been a very watchable competition, and I hope the game justifies all that's gone before it.
Yep, the unknown makes it what it is, which is sort of the dream. World Cup final. We're looking forward to it. Thanks for hanging in there, trying to get on the line. We appreciate your patience, and enjoy the rest of the tournament. Thanks for joining with us today.
My pleasure. Good luck. Bye-bye.
Thanks, Martin. Martin Tyler, World Cup play-by-play announcer and Sky Sports analyst, also a describer. And no one describes the game better than English football commentators.
Yeah, it just you could listen to them talk about whatever.
They're just the best.
It just fits.
It does.
You got the Cuthbert Gene describing our sport over here, and you've got the English voice describing that sport over there. We have it right.
See,
in commentary.
It is an English name, but yet the same sort of acknowledgement doesn't apply, I don't think.
Well, looking forward to it. Saturday.
But we try.
You know, he did mention, I mean, Morocco's story has been pretty incredible. You do get another opportunity to see them Saturday. Maybe you're betting on that. But Sunday is the day. We do have all day Saturday football and morning football. Saturday, NFL's put in some flex games. You got Colts, Vikings at 1, Browns, Ravens at 4:30, and, of course, Dolphins, Bills at 8:15. Big old Saturday night headliner there. It's going to be
big time couch weekend.
Yeah.
I know you'll have a million things to do.
I do.
But if there was ever a weekend to not do those things, Ailish, for far, this would be the weekend.
I have two Christmas parties on Saturday.
Football on football, and then, of course, hockey night in Canada. Wake up, do it all again the next morning. Mm-hmm. It's perfect.
It's going to be a great weekend for sports. Tonight, you have two things at least to tune into. Rangers and Leafs at MSG at 7, and then you've got Niners, Seahawks at 8:15. Maybe your Wake and Rake submissions come from one of those or around the board. You can send that in at 590-590, and let's make your Baby Friday even better with a little giveaway. Zach Brown Band is coming to Bud Stage next summer on July 14th, and we want to give you and a friend the chance to be there. All you have to do is tune into the Fan Morning Show every day this week and listen for the code word, then text the code word to 590-590 for your chance to win a pair of tickets to the show. Today's code word, knee deep. Text knee deep to 590-590 for your chance to win. We're giving away one last pair of tickets tomorrow, so be sure to tune in. Today's code word is knee deep. Knee deep in the water somewhere. You like that song?
I do. I was thinking about the next line. Wasn't convinced I could nail it, so I didn't go for it.
Mm.
I don't want to make another mistake on this broadcast.
I'm pretty sure I know what tomorrow's will be. We're missing a pretty significant song.
I mean, it better be. If we're doing it the right way, it better be. Maybe you could you should wait for the cue, but if you just drop the song that we're thinking about.
Do you get it
tomorrow before 7:45, 7:55. Maybe you get the leg up. I don't know. Maybe a gamble worth pursuing.
We have a great guest on the other side of the break. It's been a while since we caught up with Jackie Redmond. Going to do a whole wide NHL rundown and see if she's beliefing yet in your Toronto Maple Leafs. That's on the other side of the break on the Fan Morning Show with Justin and Ailish.